Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening. You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh. Joining me in the studio this afternoon are poets Ron Whitehead and Frank Messina, in town for the culmination of the Run for the Roses tour at Russian Recording May 6th. Welcome and thanks to both of you for taking the time to stop into the studio.
Great to be here.
So we have about an hour of your time, and during our discussion, I'd like to start with some of both of your backgrounds and the countless stories you have throughout your careers. I hope that we get into talking about the medium of poetry itself and can conclude with a discussion about using an art form like poetry, and I know you're both involved in other art forms as well, in making a difference in the activism and speaking to people that you're involved in. Ron, I'd like to start with you. As your bio states, you're one of the most famous poets in the world. The author of 19 books, work on over 20 CDs, national and international awards for literature, the founder of a nonprofit organization, and your whole life started here in the Midwest. You still live here in the Midwest. I want to start with you speaking about the impact that Kentucky has had on you and why, after traveling the entire world, you still identify right here close to South Central Indiana.
Thank you for asking, Allison. It's an honor to be here today. So glad to be here in Bloomington. I've done a lot of shows here, but it's especially good to be here with my longtime friend and brother by another mother, Jeremy Hogan, who's one of the most awesome people on the planet. I grew up on a farm in Kentucky in Ohio County, where Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass music, grew up. My mom, oldest of 13, her sister, Joe Carolyn, mama sings alto, Joe Carolyn soprano, and their dad, granddaddy, sat on the front porch of the Monroe home and played with the Monroe brothers. Happened to be cousins with the Everly brothers, who are from right across the Green River in Muhlenberg County. John Prine's their cousin, too. And that song, Paradise, I worked at the Paradise coal mine. I worked at the mines three times. My dad worked for over 40 years for Mr. Peabody. He passed away 4 years ago. But I come from a long line of farmers, coal miners, holy roller preachers, Native Americans, and strong women. I'm so honored that poetry has carried this country boy. I'm proud of my hillbilly heritage to all over the world. Got to study at Oxford for a little while. My professor Valentine Cunningham, came to the door, introduced myself. He looked down at my feet. I looked down. I said, "What?" He said, "You've got shoes on." I said, "Ha, ha." He said, "I didn't know people from Kentucky wore shoes." I said, "A smart ass. I was raised by a 10th degree smart ass and a 10th degree badass. Daddy, we'll get along real well." Turned out his favorite singing group was the Everly Brothers, and we got along great. So I'm proud of being from Kentucky. I'm not one of these people who's like, I tried to change my accent so I can sound like everybody else. I'm proud of every aspect of my entire life. Every event, every person has been a gift and a teacher to me. I embrace all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I take the Kentucky gospel wherever I go, and I go. And I'm also happy to be here at the end of the Run for the Roses tour with my longtime brother in the trenches of activism, poetry, warfare. We've been on many tours, including the War Poets Tour in Europe, Frank Messina. So I'm going to shut my mouth and let Frank talk now.
Well, that's a perfect transition. Frank, again, thanks for visiting the station this afternoon. I am curious about the connection between the two of you and how your work has grown together over the years.
Well, thanks for having me, and it's great to be back here in Bloomington. I was here, actually, oddly enough, back in 1991 at the university, studying with Alan Dugan, took a workshop here, Pulitzer Prize winner poet, and I've been through here once or twice since then, but I did spend a solid month at the university here. And Jeremy, who I've known for many years now, is an old friend. And anytime he comes to New Jersey or New York, he's welcome at my place. He knows that. He's been there. And it's very special to be here. Through Kentucky, last 4 or 5 days, got to go to the Derby in between our shows, which was spectacular. Ron and I and musician Tyrone Cotton, who will be there tonight as well, performing with us. He's on his way up right now as we speak. We went to the Derby together. We had a show at
The Haymarket Whiskey Bar at the Tim Faulkner Gallery. We did a couple of private shows, and we've just been raising hell and having a good time.
Like we've been doing for years.
Yeah.
Ron and I have been traveling for the last close to 20 years. In fact, I think next year it'll be 20 years since we met.
That's correct.
And I think Ron will tell it.
I can relate to how that exactly happened.
He gives a better story on how it happened. But since then, we've been really traveling to many countries and to many states. And like Ron, a love for poetry, it really carries in every aspect that I do, everything I do, every aspect of my life, whether it be work or play or the way I treat others. I find that poetry, for me, traveling around the country, you're able to find out what's on people's minds directly through the literature, you know, and through the poetry. And living in a very diverse, growing up in a very diverse city and very diverse area in the New York area. My father was raised in South Bronx, my mom in Manhattan, and my dad got out of the Bronx in the 50s, and in the 60s raised a family in New Jersey. I was the youngest of four, and am the youngest of four, as far as I know. And I've been living in Jersey City for the last dozen
years. You were the only one who was planned, though, weren't you?
Yeah, as according to my father, he told me on his deathbed, "Fear not, son, you were the only planned one." All the others were... So getting my start really doing poetry and spoken word, the tradition of the spoken word through jazz musicians that I knew and rock and alternative rock musicians in the 80s growing up, I was fortunate enough to have some of the finest musicians within arm's reach, you know, in New York City and in Newark and in Jersey City, performing all around. New Jersey's a home to many poets, Allen Ginsberg, William Carlos Williams, Amiri Baraka, and many others. So I'm very proud of my New Jersey heritage, my New York heritage, but I also carry in my pocket something I am very proud of, and that is my card as a Kentucky colonel. I am a colonel, and so is Ron. I'm real proud of that because I love Kentucky. This was my 12th, over a dozen times I've been to Louisville and to Kentucky in general. And I've performed at the Louisville Slugger Museum on Thursday.
The first poet to ever read at the historic Louisville Slugger Museum. And Frank and I, to add a footnote there, our favorite president of the United States happens to also be a Kentucky boy, Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm, that's true. And I have some Kentucky blood in me. I really do. I feel a brethren here. It's similar to when I went to Ireland and felt a kinship with the people there, more so as much, if not more, than my relatives and friends in Italy and in Sicily. When I went to Dublin, I felt very welcome, very, very at home there. And I similarly feel that way in Kentucky.
Well, we got the Irish blood in Kentucky. I mm-hmm. got it in me, and mm-hmm. I think Frank and I are ultimately Irish Sicilian hillbillies.
Well, my grandparents grew up in the mountains. You know, they grew up in the mountains of Sicily, outside of which is my last name, Messina, which is a city in Sicily. And my grandparents grew up just north of the city in a place called San Biagio Platina, which is basically in the mountains.
Okay.
And I have visited there. I saw where my grandfather was born. And I plan to go back there soon again. But I have that same feeling in some parts of Kentucky when I go through the hills and even going right through the Pee Wee Reese mountain range there, which is named after Pee Wee, I believe, I hope. Of the baseball player, Hall of Famer, Brooklyn Dodger, and his son Mark is a good friend of ours. And
Pee-wee's another Kentucky boy. Yeah. I'm honored to be friends with him and his wife Dottie, and longtime friends with their son Mark, who's a Hollywood filmmaker.
Filmmaker, yeah.
And Pee-wee's the player for the Brooklyn Dodgers, the shortstop, who befriended the first black professional athlete, Jackie Robinson. Check out the film 42. Mm-hmm. Check out Mark's 5-part ESPN series on the Brooklyn Dodgers. But it was Pee-wee being a Kentucky boy who befriended Jackie Robinson. And in one particular play, the fans were booing, throwing stuff, calling Jackie every name in the book. And Pee-wee just walked over, put his arm around Jackie's shoulder, and stood there talking to him until the crowd shut the hell up. That was the breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ron,
that's the kind of friendship Frank and I have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly where I'm going. I can't wait. I want to hear the story of the moment you met and how the sparks flew from then. Frank said that you would tell that story better.
It's a long story. I'll cut to the chase. In April of 1994, I had been working for a year. I had brought my friend Lawrence Ferlinghetti to Kentucky. And Ferlinghetti, it took me a year to get him to come to Kentucky. Ferlinghetti, I just called him March 24th and sang him happy 94th birthday. Ferlinghetti is the founder, the father of the first paperback bookstore in the United States, 261 Columbus Avenue, North Beach, San Francisco, City Lights Books. Ferlinghetti told me finally one day on a phone call, he said, "You're not going to give up, are you?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, if you take me to Thomas Merton's grave, I'll come." Thomas Merton happened to be a major influence on me as one of the greatest spiritual leaders, most prolific writers of the last century, and still is to this day. I had never visited his grave at the Abbey of Gethsemane, which is an hour south of Louisville. So I said, "Done deal, Ferlinghetti." So he came, and so we visited, got the grand tour of the Abbey, and Ferlinghetti told me, the last night of Merton's life in the USA, he stayed with me at City Lights in San Francisco before he went to Asia, where he attended an international ecumenical religious conference where he had been corresponding with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. They had three talks. The Dalai Lama told me that it was those talks with Merton that changed his life forever. And then Merton, after the third talk, he went back. It was a hot, humid day. He went back and supposedly he was electrocuted, taking a shower. I have doubts about that. He was outspoken against war. He wanted women to have more equal rights in the Catholic Church. But anyway, we're leaving the Abbey of Gethsemane, and Ferlinghetti says, "You ought to bring the Dalai Lama. He would love to visit Merton's grave." So I worked for a year, and I brought the Dalai Lama came. Let me just say that. I ended up meeting him, asking him to give me a message to share with young people of all ages, which he did, as a result of which I wrote the poem Never Give Up, which is now all over the world. It's been in National Geographic. He's got it framed hanging in his private office in Dharamsala, India. I came to here to Bloomington, to the Tibetan Culture Center. I was here with Jeremy. 2,000 people from around the world were invited for the dedication of the International Peace Center. I quoted a poem to Muhammad Ali in the entranceway. The Secret Service almost killed me. They came in, and I was like quoting this poem to Ali and his daughter, and they came up behind me and grabbed me and slammed me against the wall, pushed their forearm against my throat. Ali walked over, slid his hand in between them, grabbed my hand, looked in my eyes, and squeezed it real hard. Well, I had a similar experience with the Dalai Lama. I told him about that was April 94. I said, in May, New York University has asked me to produce a 48-hour nonstop music and poetry insomniacathon to kick off their week-long 50-year celebration of the Beat Generation. And so I had lined up I told him about it. He gave me the message. I'd lined up 300 performers from around the world. I was full. I started getting these calls, these messages from some guy who had a New York, New Jersey accent. I wasn't quite sure. It seemed a little different each time he left a message. He said, "Nah, you got to give me a chance. I'm the best. I got my band. We're going to perform Octopoet." And so I finally said, "Look, you know, I like persistence. If anybody's persistent, I am." So I called him back. And he had left his name. I said, Frank? He said, yeah. Frank Messina? Yeah. Ron Whitehead. And he said, damn, I can't believe you called me back. I didn't think you were going to. I said, look, I've opened up a space for you and your band to perform at the Insomniacathon. I went, I sat by my friend Allen Ginsberg. We heard Frank and his band perform, and they blew both Allen and me away. I went backstage afterwards, introduced myself. I said, we're going to do some more work together. And we've been best friends ever since. True story. True. God, it tears me up. So it'll be 20 years next year.
Yeah.
So you recognize something of yourself in him.
Immediately, both ways, immediately.
Yeah.
Brothers, definitely.
I want to get into the work that both of you do. Ron, I'm curious when you started writing, or if writing was even the first expressions of poetry that you were using, and maybe what other writings inspired you to get into that path.
I spend half of my time in nature and half reading. I joined a history book club and a biography book club when I was 5. That's when I started school. We didn't have kindergarten. I went to grade 1 through 12 Centertown School, 300 students in the country, in the wilderness of Kentucky. I've always loved poetry. We dwell in space. We measure space with time. If that's all there was, would be living metronomic, boring lives. There's this other magical element called rhythm. And so as I wandered as a little boy wandering the wilderness, I always walked with rhythm. And as I walked, words came to me. I would, even if I memorized songs, which I often did, I quickly changed the words to the songs and made my own songs with my words. And so I've always talked with myself, and I sing my work like William Blake. I love to sing anything. I just make up stuff and sing it. I sing my own poems, and so I've been doing that since I was a little boy. But the way I grew up in the fierce pioneer lands of Kentucky, if Daddy had asked, well, son, what are you going to do when you grow up? I'm going to be a poet, Daddy. It would have just been one more ass whipping. And so I didn't come out of the closet as a poet until I left home when I was 17. And it felt so good when new friends asked me, what are you going to do? What are your dreams? I'm a poet. I'm not sure where that's going to lead me or take me, but I'm a poet. I've known it all my life. And so 25 years ago, I built a bridge. I've had over 100 jobs in my life. I started working when I was 5. I built a bridge from where I was to where I want it to be, one step at a time. If I can do it, anybody can. And there's nothing like living and being your dream. That doesn't mean life's going to be easy. Every day is a challenge. But when you're living and being your dream, there's no battle that you can't at least fight, if not win. So I'm a poet, by God, and I'm proud to say it.
You've mentioned your father twice. I assume he came around and supported the career that his son ended up taking?
My dad was a coal miner. He and Mama, I didn't know this till I grew up, got married because they got pregnant with me. And that's, I think, I'm the oldest of 6, and I think that's one reason he took a lot of his anger out on me. My dad was a fierce man, a good man, but fierce. He did not spare the rod, let me tell you, or the whip, or, you know, anything that was close to him, or his hand, his fist. But I finally, 3 weeks before Daddy died, we healed our relationship. Shoot, it's hard to talk about. So, but Daddy, despite the fact that he dropped out of high school in the 9th grade, I asked him why. He said, I'd rather be working than going to school. He would get into fights and just clear the room out just so they'd send him home for a month. He hated school, but he loved poetry. Like Muhammad Ali, he memorized the entire Hiawatha, and he subscribed to Reader's Digest magazine, and it had this thing called Word Power in it, and there were 10 words in there, and he knew I was good at words. So he'd call me, Ronnie, come in here. And I'd go in, and he'd spell this word, and I'd spell it. Tell me the definition, and I'd tell him. And so that was, we didn't come together that often, but that was one way we did. So I knew he loved words. But even after I was getting written up, featured in magazines and newspapers around the world, Daddy was like, how much they paying you? And it was like, finally, the Ojai County newspaper where I grew up did a feature, front page inside article. Finally, Daddy started respecting me because the local people, well, he thought, well, shoot, the people around here respect him. Maybe he is all right. So that was, it was a ridiculous breakthrough, but it happened.
Well, it's a joy to have Frank Messina and Ron Whitehead joining us in the studio this afternoon. They're both coming through Bloomington to conclude the Run for the Roses tour. Stay tuned. We'll come back to Interchange in just a moment.
It's true, you know, the whole thing with the earning of the respect from our elders and our parents. You know, my folks didn't similarly. They didn't really take my work seriously until they started seeing in the newspapers.
Yeah.
And seeing books and things that I wrote. And,
yeah.
And the publishing places, and that's pretty interesting how. I grew up with them saying, don't believe everything you read in the newspaper. But then when the article on me came out, they believed it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Just really strange. Yeah. You know, I remember staying in the same house as them, you know, growing up, and they, you know, it's just, they didn't take it seriously until, but they were supportive. I could talk a little bit about that, about, you know, it's tough, you know, every parent, I think, wants their kid to be definitely happy, that number one. And I think once my folks saw that I was happy doing what I'm doing, that was enough for them. And where the in the end, where my father really was a tough guy, but a gang leader in the South Bronx. I didn't know even an iota of what he had gone through until toward the end when we started talking more. When he was dying, he got in 2005 was diagnosed with inoperable cancer. And we spent a lot of time watching baseball games and chatting. And growing up, there, he always had a scar on his calf, big scar. And he always told me it was from falling off a ladder. Finally, you know, he told me how it really happened. And it's a pretty gruesome story in a gang fight, and how somebody cracked a bottle and got into a fight. And he says, but, you know, I walked away from it, you know. You know, he told me some horrible things that happened. He had to fight his way from the beginning to the end, and he didn't want us to have to do that.
Yeah. And we grew up in a similar way, even yeah. though he grew up in New York and New Jersey, and I grew up in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And we have so much in common.
It was a survival thing, really. And I think my dad, he cherished education. He knew that was a way out. His parents were not educated. My father went to night school. He worked during the day as a butcher shop. He had odd jobs, but at night he went to college, he got his credits, he finally graduated, put himself through, got out of the gangs, told them, which you never can do, but actually since he was the leader of the gang, he goes, he gave the ranks to somebody else and goes, I'm out of here, I got a family now, I'm a family man, I'm saving my family. My dad was, we had the same name growing up. I'm the youngest, unlike Ron, Ron's the oldest, I'm the youngest of four, but I had his name, Frank. And going back to what Ron mentioned earlier about the planned one, he's making an inside joke, which I'll share with you, which is, you know, I have two older brothers, Robert and John, but why is the youngest named Frank? Usually the oldest, the first son, would be named, you know, after the father. Usually that seems like a traditional thing. And how do you know that there's going to be another one anyway? So what's the risk? So, well, when I would go visit my father, he would be in the hospital. He was diagnosed with inoperable bile duct cancer near the liver. And he told me there's not much time. Even before the doctors told him that, he already knew. He just knew it. Had a softball-sized tumor in his gut. And we watched baseball games. We watched the Mets play. We're big Mets fans. My dad was a big New York baseball Giants fan in the 50s. And 58, they moved to San Francisco. The team and the Dodgers moved to LA, broke the hearts of old National League fans in New York, and there was nobody left but the Yankees. Well, my father grew up in the South Bronx, but he wasn't going to be a Yankee fan. He just wasn't a Yankee fan. So the Mets were created, and in 62, he became a fan, and as a result, his kids became brainwashed into being Mets fans, which New York Metropolitan Baseball Club, the New York Mets. So we watched games toward the end there, and he told me stories, true stories about his life growing up, and he also let me know how appreciative and how respectful and how much he loved not only me, but what I do, and how proud he was. And I had a poem that I wrote, a very brief poem, which is about him being in the hospital, and you know, he's basically saying yeah, he was asleep and I went in there and I was brokenhearted and all of this, and he said to me, come closer, I have something to tell you, come here, I have something to tell you. Well, what's he got to tell me now? You know, he's on his deathbed, I'm all a wreck here, you know, I'm a mess. And he came and I listened and I leaned in real close to what my dad had to say, and he's like, "Oh, you were the only planned one." You know, all the others were, and we laughed so hard. But that's what kind of man he was. He not only protected his family and protected me from some of the bad things in the world, but also protected me from that pain and from his own demise. He didn't worry, and he didn't agonize over his own pain. He maybe in his own private time, I'm sure he did, but he didn't show it, and he did not. He protected the family until the end, and he died peacefully. Oh, we were all around him, and so I dedicated my book, Full Count, the Book of Mets Poetry, which came out in 2009, 4 years after he passed. I dedicated it to him, to my dad, who taught me how to how to handle full counts, screwballs, curveballs, and hits in the chin, and know how to slide home safely, and how to deal with being tagged out once in a while.
Frank, that's a great introduction then into some more of your work, of course known as the Mets poet for the baseball poetry about one of my favorite teams as well, really? The New York Mets. Mm-hmm. But your work goes far beyond that, and I'm curious about some of your other projects, even going beyond literature into acting, mm-hmm. painting, music work, if you can mm-hmm. speak about some of that.
Sure. Well, we were talking about bridges before. Poetry is my first love. I wrote since I'm probably 10, 12 years old. I had some bad teachers, but I had a couple of good teachers. And those good teachers kind of saved me from really going into the dark abyss. And I mentioned my folks earlier. They were good teachers too. My brother, well, they weren't formally teachers, but informal home teachers, you know, kind of sitting around and reading about American history. That's where I really got my first, that's where I first discovered Walt Whitman, was through studying the Civil War. My dad was a huge Civil War buff. And so we used to read the books, history books, and I discovered Whitman through the history because during the Civil War, Whitman went looking for his brother George, who was a Union soldier, and they got a telegram to the family and saying that their loved one is somewhere in the hospitals in the South. You have to go find it, you know, we'll let you know. And there was no text messaging, you know, internet and so forth back then. So Walt decided to go look for him. And that journey that he took from New York to the South and to the war states, that journey that he took resulted in his series of poems that he ended up putting into Leaves of Grass, which is a series of poems called Drum Taps. And as a kid, that inspired me, the whole thing about searching for something, searching for someone. And I was like, I hope he finds him. You know, reading about his story, I really hope. And he did.
And he loved Lincoln, too.
He loved Lincoln. Yeah. He loved Lincoln. There's a lot to Whitman that, you know, I could go on about how his work has inspired me, but also his story. His story has. So that's kind of that romantic notion. I was always a lover of stories and nonfiction stories. I mean, I love fiction, but I love nonfiction historical stories. So poetry got into, started working with music just by a natural hybrid group I put together called Spoken Motion. We put together that together in the 90s. We performed all over New York. Again, back to cross culture. I'm an Italian-American kid in from New Jersey, and now we're getting into a real cross, you know, and I love that. That's that to me, the bridges. I've discovered more about what's on the minds of people through poetry and culture, different cultures. The cowboy poets, you know, Native American Indian poets, black poets, the Hispanic. I mean, there's so many. The feminists. I mean, I learned how to open my heart and my mind and soul up, open up to all people through poetry, because it was very difficult growing up in an area where there was, you know, there was some racial discrimination, but not, you know, it was a subtle, it wasn't overt, but you had the Italian communities and the black communities and Hispanic, and I grew up pretty much in an Italian-American neighborhood. But I had the jazz musicians around me, the musicians, we worked together. I did that for many, many years and still continue to do it. I sit in with groups, rock and roll bands that asked me to come in. I just read at the Capitol Theater at Port Chester, New York with Max Creek, which is a New England band, been around for 42 years. They just celebrated their 42nd birthday. They play with the
longer than the Grateful
Dead, Allman Brothers, Fish, you know, or okay. You know, those Fish is influenced by them. So, you know, I've worked with some had the opportunity and been blessed to work with some great people, great musicians. And then reading the film, I've always been interested in film. And again, back to stories. I was asked to read for certain film parts, documentaries, growing up, probably throughout my career. But as of late, things have heated up a little more. In 3 years ago, I worked with Mark Reese, the filmmaker we talked about, Pee-wee's kid. He's a dear friend. Mark put together the Kerouac documentary called Jack Kerouac Slept Here. And it's about Orlando, the Kerouac house. It's the house where Jack lived when On the Road was published. Mm. And he lived there with his mother in a little bungalow. He also...
we've performed there on our Florida tour.
We've performed there.
Frank's got a poem on the wall there.
I'm on a wall there. I serve as an advisory for them on the advisory board. Really more of an informal thing, but I help get some ideas together, help them raise money, maybe do some benefit readings and that kind of thing. But Jack wrote The Dharma Bums there. It's interesting...
Great book.
Interesting home to be in. So
introduce Buddhism to the American youth, Dharma Bums.
Yeah. So, you know, there was that influence. There was the poetry, the music. And I think I was naturally asked to be in that film because of my, I wasn't acting. I was basically being myself, and they were interviewing me, Frank Messina, not being another character. But I also love doing impressions.
I keep telling him to go on tour. He calls me up often in the middle of the night, and whoever he's mimicking, he sounds exactly like him, including myself. He said, "This is the Bone Man," but he sounds just like me. And I said, "You need to take that show on the road, Hoss." Yeah. Well, he's really good at it.
I started doing that. I did that quite a bit, but I got asked to do some minor roles and some bit parts. And some feature parts. So, as of recently, there's two projects I worked on. One is a movie called Blood Ties, which is coming out, I think, in October. I have a role in that film that stars James Caan and Billy Crudup, and Marion Cotillard, and John Ventimiglia is in that. And I have a recurring...
John's a great guy.
Yeah, good guy. He reads with David sometimes.
Yeah.
But we also... And this minor... this role, recurring role on Boardwalk Empire, HBO, Martin Scorsese production. And, I've been filming. We're shooting again later this week. We'll go back to New York tomorrow. So I'm shooting. So every couple of weeks I get a haircut, which is 1920s style. But I love I love doing film. I love it. I'm embracing that process of my... creative career. I'll always be a poet, continue writing and publishing books, but the acting, the film, I mean, that's just it's happening now, and that's what I'm embracing. And things have been good. I've been asked to do some projects that are coming up, some film, really, I'm very excited about. So things are pretty good, you know. But that's how the music was a natural thing. The acting came later.
Okay. Again, joining us here in the WFHB studios this afternoon, our poets Ron Whitehead and Frank Messina. And we're more than halfway through our conversation already, and I'm not going to let you leave the station before we get to discussing the medium of poetry. It's very important to me to hear from you. Why not just reflect on the world in prose and complete sentences and words that mean exactly what they say? Why poetry?
In the beginning was the Word. And guess what? The Word is still here, and we are the Word. And the Word is poetry. It's not prose. It's not grammar. I learned everything about grammar, about scansion, all the traditional forms of poetry. And then I put the hood down on my vintage Miata. I took a midnight drive on the left coast highway, and I tossed every bit of grammar and scansion out the window, down the cliff into the Pacific Ocean. And then I went my own way, which is the only way. We all have an original voice flowing through us every second, nonstop. One reason I dropped out of college the first time around was because I got so sick and tired of pompous-ass professors saying, "There's nothing original to say. The best you can do is paraphrase what I say back to me, but don't quote me exactly in your own words, otherwise you'll get kicked out of college." And I finally flipped the bird to all of them and walked away for 13 years. And I went back... I just decided, I realized what my dream was and is, and I wanted to make that classroom experience real. If it ain't real, it ain't no effing deal, as far as I'm concerned. And so I managed to teach college and university for 25 years and make it real, and it just became more and more cloning. So I finally turned and walked away. I've given over 6,000 performances of my own work, creative work, around the world. I dwell in the realms of the creative imagination. That's the only place where I can breathe. And that is the realm of poetry, the sacred and profane realm of poetry. That's where rhythm is, rhythm, that alchemical, magical, the real fire, rhythm. Prose is like, I'd rather shoot myself in the foot than write prose. And I've written a lot of it. But it's painful. It's like assembly line. One summer I worked on the Whirlpool refrigerator assembly line in Evansville, Indiana, 120 degrees, big things of salt tablets. People are drinking whiskey out of their big thermoses and taking speed. And I'm rolling three little putty balls to put into each one of the 2,000 refrigerators coming through on my shift. I dreamed about rolling putty balls. You know, I would go crazy. 3 months. Thank God it was only 3 months. I would have gone nuts. So poetry is the opposite of all that. It's the opposite. It's real life. It's getting naked in the springtime and getting on your motorcycle, on your car, driving cross country with your lover, drinking red wine, howling at the moon. It's the total enjoyment of what life is all about. That's poetry. That's why I'm a poet.
Amen. Amen, a woman.
Frank Messina and Ron Whitehead joining us in the studio this afternoon. They're both coming through Bloomington to conclude the Run for the Roses tour. Stay tuned. We'll come back to Interchange in just a moment. Seen poetry change since you were first exposed to it through, I assume, books and live readings? Is it more and or less accessible now to this generation? How are they getting it? And does it have that same effect now that it's coming through these new mediums?
Go ahead, Frank. I can go on for hours on this.
Well, I was asked a similar question to that recently from a European magazine that interviewed me about this. And they asked about how it has changed. I mean, the obvious answer to that, it's not necessarily the correct one, but it's an obvious one that's immediate, is the advent of the internet and social media. So people are reporting what's on their minds readily and almost to the point of ad nauseum. But some of it is poetry, but it's reporting what's on the mind. And in a way, that can be interpreted as, if it was to do orally like we are here, it would be considered spoken word, perhaps. And then since they write it, it's what is it? Some of it is prose, some of it's fragmented poetry. I don't know, but I've worked. I've been a student of poetry, but I would look at myself as more as a student of life. I find out what's on the minds of people by traveling, and by listening to the poets. If you really go back to in history. Before language, before there was written language, there was the oral tradition, and people told stories to each other. And only in the 20th century,
told them with a rhythm, and the poet told was respected equally to the king and queen.
Many times there was a drummer to keep the rhythm.
Yeah,
you know. So So as it got more formalized, it became more sophisticated, it became more inaccessible. And then only the real literate, it was accessible to the literate people.
The ivory tower academia crowd,
right.
Puke.
Well, so that was just, that's an obvious thing also historically. But there was always the oral tradition. People telling stories, passing stories down to the family. And some of it was told through poetry. Some of the greatest poetry, I think that American poetry, if you really go back to it, if you go back to the Civil War era and to the slave poetry, which is most of it's anonymous because they didn't want to be captured because of the poems they were writing, but they were free slave. And what was that based on? It was, a lot of it was gospel, religious based. They became hymns, even, you know, gospel hymns that they invented to give themselves salvation. And I think that what I found immediately struck a chord with me when I got closer to the poetry, but also the poets, is that sense of that raw nerve of life happening, and I'm tapping it, I'm feeling it. It's not the news. The news is delivering information, and poetry delivers information, and it's good poetry strikes a chord somewhere, and that's where I like to attempt to get into. I hope that some of my poems get to that point and get to that place, that rhythmic place, that place that can be considered maybe prayer-like in a way, or serves that purpose. And poems do that in a way, not necessarily in a religious sense, but a life sense, you know. And that's that to me is keeps me coming back. It not only keeps me coming back as a poet to share my work, but also listen to the others. I've been to many, many readings growing up. I don't get out to too many of them anymore like I used to because I'm so busy, but I get out and I listen and I find out what's on the minds of people not only in America but all around the world. Today, there are the poetry, I believe, is definitely more accessible. A lot has to do with removing the formality of the process of writing poetry.
But it's so important, and this is one thing that I tell young people all the time, not only teaching college, university for 25 years, but, you know, Ice Cube and I had a long talk about this subject, about the terrible lyrics that were being written by rap, young rap and hip-hop artists, and we both agreed, you don't even know your roots. Go back and study your deep roots and write some lyrics with social consciousness instead of, you know, guns and money and hoes and all that. And so he published a piece right after that that was in all the music magazines. But it's so important that if you're going to be whatever you're going to be, a poet, for example, since that's what we're talking about, learn the history of poetry.
Yes.
You're not going to be a great poet until, do what I did. Learn it all, then throw it away and go your own way. But there's always going to be those elements of those traditional styles, forms, rhythms in what you're doing. And music is central. Music is central. Just like Jack Kerouac incorporating jazz rhythms into his prose, James Joyce incorporated musical rhythms into all his prose. If your prose is not rhythmic, it's just going to be metronomic. It's going to be da-da-da-da-da.
It becomes an article. It becomes a news article. And that could be, and even a good news article has a rhythm to it, but few and far between these days. No, seriously, I'm not trying to be, get it on journalists, but I find that between the deadlines and the competition that exists in the writing industry, whether it be reporting, with journalism, and poetry, there's a lot of cutting corners, and you know, I'd rather write less and come out with, I would come out with three or four really good pieces than 100 bad pieces. There's no room for it, really. Well, there's room for it, but it doesn't go anywhere. If you really want to serve, the people say serve the country in a way, and if you're not in the military, if you're not doing anything, if you're a poet, you can serve by helping others, by helping them write and understand poetry, and if that's what you do. You know, it could be anything. It could be a flautist. You could be a musician, a photographer. If you can help others, if you could raise the bar a little bit.
Uplift and inspire, you know? Comfort and heal, awaken and entertain. And entertainment is something that is so important, but so many people in professional positions of journalism, writing, whatever, forget that aspect, and it's the rhythmic aspect. Yeah. Even if you're using that journalistic style, that everyday speech, which Hemingway was a master at, one of my favorite writers, Knut Hamsun, the Norwegian, was a master at. If you bury, even in those everyday words, the diction and the syntax, the structure of the sentence, you can put rhythm in there. The early poets sung their histories to the people. They listened to the stories, went from one town to the other, but they sung their histories, which became the bards, the bardic poems. And so that's something that is too often missing.
Yeah.
From what's called poetry.
Mm-hmm.
With us, I think it's more accessible. I think what Ron has been doing for his whole life, what I've been doing for the last 20 some odd years, and what so many other poets are doing out there, which is bringing it to the people, the masses. And I hope, I mean, that's something that excites me about continuing doing what I do, the baseball poetry. I've introduced poetry to an entire fan base without they don't have probably a poetry book on their bookshelf, but they might have this book, or I've gone into the stadium and read my poetry, or been on TV reading one of my baseball poems or something, or on the radio or whatnot, and it introduces them to something. To me, I get off on that as an artist, as a poet, because poetry's been such a dying art. You know, I'm a fan of the underdog. I'm a Mets fan. You know, I'm a fan of poetry. You know, how many times have I done gigs and they have the rock band here, the jazz guy here, and, well, we'll put the poet on while the band is setting up in the background. You know, we'll just put you up and we'll like, everybody will be walking around you and sound men will be lifting stuff up. And, God. Again, back to bringing it to the masses. I mean, having those opportunities to bring poetry.
That's exactly, you know? Right. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. One thing, my parents, poetry is the most respected of all the literary arts. Frank and I were blessed to perform with some of the best, most popular bands and musicians on the planet. And guess what? Nearly all of them want to be poets. It is the most respected.
Want to be poets.
Yeah. But going back to, you know, why we do what we do, well, one of the main reasons is, in my case, Mom and Daddy taught me through their actions, not their words, when I was growing up, that we are all never to look up to or down at anybody. We are all in this shoulder to shoulder, eyeball to eyeball. There ain't no elite crowd. There are no scumbags in the gutter. You know, we could be either place, but we're honored to be right here with everybody. And so that's why, you know, we perform all over the world. It doesn't matter who the audience is. We just want to make it real, and that's what we do.
One question I have about poetry, and then we'll conclude with that term that both of you guys have referred to, the social consciousness of your poems and the work that you're doing. But something that strikes me about poetry is that when you read a completed poem, when you have a completed poem, every element seems so perfectly placed. And so I'm curious about your process. Do you write a perfect line and then you find the next perfect line? Or do you write a draft and then you have to rearrange every single word or find the correct thing to go in? What's your process from going from this feeling, I've heard this story on the road and I want to express it to the world, mm-hmm. to that perfectly placed piece?
Well, I've had, through my experience writing and through my process, I've had both experiences where you have that moment where you write the incredible three lines and you say, this is great. Then now this is the beginning of a great poem. And hopefully it turns out that way. And then 9 out of 10 times, it's you have to work at it a bit. You write, and then you go back and edit. The editing process has been a lost art.
It's important. First thought, best thought, get it on the paper, but then go back and make edits.
Some I find it through my process is to write a summary, or like kind of like I look at poetry, a good poem as a snapshot, a photograph. Good photograph. A good photograph is a flash. It happens. If you write on a piece of paper what the poem basically, what you have in mind, the skeleton, you come back to it, then you formulate it. There's very few poems that I wrote in one sitting where they became publishable, if not perhaps masterful. I hope they were. I don't know. But there's one poem that I wrote called Bicycle, which I knew right when I was done with it that it was probably that I, if I died the next day, it wouldn't bother me so much because the poem to me was hit it exactly.
Inspired by 9/11 and
9/11. Yeah,
he wrote so many great poems after that.
Well, so maybe that will lead into then this aspect of using poetry to make to have some social awakenings.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I'll respond to that. You don't
please.
Have to go any further. In May 2008. I produced with Olafur Gunnarsson, Iceland's leading novelist, the first and only Beat Generation Festival 3 miles outside of Reykjavik. After the festival, I solo climbed the Viking Mountain. There's a great history to the Viking Mountain. I was nearly blown off 3 times to my death. Many people have been blown off. I crawled over and under a rock for 15 minutes. I had a series of epiphanies. At the end of which, I stood up, opened my backpack, and took out the only thing I had in it, which was a 1.5 liter bottle of red wine. I raised it to the howling Norse gods, and I drank in one fell swoop half of it. Then I made my descent. When I got down, I wrote this poem, which has been translated into many languages now, the Storm Generation Manifesto. We tip our hats to the lost and the beat. We go our own way. We are the storm generation. We are the storm. We are a new generation of artists. We are poets, writers, painters, sculptors, composers, musicians, singers, dancers, playwrights, filmmakers. We are creative expression. We blow away lies and injustice. We are graphic. We are honest. We tell it like it is. We are fierce. We are brutal. We are compassionate. We are gentle. We are kind. We have soft hearts. We are free. We are spiritual. We are sex. We dwell in the realms of the creative imagination. We are the creative imagination. We know that the shortest distance between 2 points is creative distance. We pay attention to the long forgotten wisdom voices of the forest. We vanquish the overtly materialistic greedy who intentionally destroy mountains. We honor mountains and oceans and eagles and wolves. We cherish Mother Earth and all her terrible beauty. We are nonviolent spiritual warriors. We are lightning. We are thunder. We are song poems. We are fearless visionary poets. We have wolf eyes. We are more than the eye of the storm. We are the storm. We refuse. We will not bow down. We will never give up. We are God's open nerve. We are God's open nerve. We are the storm generation. The storm generation. The storm. The storm. Storm.
Amen.
Just about at time. Let me ask one more question. We'll see if we can squeeze it in. Because I'm curious about, you mentioned the social media has come in. And I think it's almost ironic that it's kind of imposed almost a haiku, something like Twitter, where you have that 120 characters. And so you do all of a sudden have to choose your words very carefully and think and distill your point in a way. So I am curious what you see as a future of poetry and how people are using, I mean, this is the same medium that people are using to start social revolutions, the Arab Spring. Even here at Indiana University, we just had a student strike during the IU Trustees Board of Trustees Board meeting, and they used these mediums to gather the people together, to hold demonstrations,
sure,
to connect. So I am curious if you can speak a little bit on what you're seeing as the new young poets and if they are using the social media to get further.
Well, I believe that the young especially believe that it is helping to bring people together. And it does, physically, saying, bring these people together. We're meeting here. We're having an Occupy Wall Street movement here. We're meeting at this, at Washington Square Park, or we're meeting here at the university, or so forth. It does in a literal, in a physical and literal sense. But ultimately, when the electric goes out, and the plugs are pulled, and there's nothing left, there's going to be what? There's going to be paper and pen. Because that's the problem, and that's exactly what's been passed as an executive order, that all the internet could be shut down in one swoop if someone doesn't like what's happening, and what? Everybody on Twitter and social media sites such as Facebook will be completely rendered useless. So what do you have to, what will you resort to? You're going to resort to back to the written and the spoken word. And that's what it'll come down. The lights go out, you're going to have a candle, and you're going to have a book, and you're going to have a pen. And it's going to return back to that. Don't ever lose that if you really are into social consciousness. Yes, use the technology, but don't ever lose the ability and the basic tools that we were born basically raised with and have forgotten, which is the pen and paper.
It's been an absolute joy to have Ron Whitehead and Frank Messina in town and in the studios of WFHB again for Interchange. I'm Allison Mixers. Thank you both for coming down to the studio.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of community radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.